But look me down this deep, dark hole.
To New Horror Express, your monthly podcast, giving you a look at the latest in horror, as well as chatting to the best breaking talent the genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and in this month's episode, we take a slightly different direction. As previously, we have only looked at horror movies. But today, we delve into the world of horror literature by talking to two up-and-coming horror writers, Laura Maro and Christy DeMeester. In the first interview, I chat to Laura about her debut novella, Naming the Bones, while in the second, I chat to Christy about her debut novel, Beneath. I also chat to both of them about horror inspirations, how they got into fiction writing, and upcoming projects they both have. Anyway, that's enough for me. Let's now dive straight into our first interview with Laura Maro. Hello, Laura, and welcome to New Horror Express.
Hi, Scott. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. First of all, let's talk about your novella that you wrote for Dark Minds Press, Naming the Bones, which I've recently read and is very good. Tell me a little bit about how the writing of that developed?
I always wanted to write about Elephant and Castle because that's where I grew up, and you don't really read a lot of stories set in that area. It's for good reason. It's not the best part of London. So I always had that as a starting point. Mm-hmm. And I've also always had a fascination with the underground, sort of tunnels and underground in general, but specifically the London Underground, because obviously when you grow up in London, you can't avoid it. It's a huge part of your life there. Around about the time, so I actually wrote the novella about a year before I was approached by Dark Minds. So I'd been sitting on it for a bit. Yeah. And at that time, I'd been really interested in, my dad had recommended me this book, which was Haunted London Underground. And it was just, you know, stories of, exactly, it sounds like ghosts on the London Underground and paranormal phenomena and stuff like that. And there was a particular story in there that about... during the war in Bethnal Green tube station, I think it was a bomb outside or an air raid or something like that. And there was a huge stampede for people trying to get into the underground station to shelter. And lots of people were crushed and killed during the stampede to get to safety. Long story short, the ghost story is about it was a real reported story about a man who had been working in Bethnal Green station during the night shift. And had heard the voices of people screaming on the stairs, but nobody was there. So that kind of fed into this idea of how trauma gets retained and, you know, the underground almost has a memory. So that was kind of my starting point for it.
Very interesting. It's not a story I was aware of, but that's... So, but yeah, and is that how you kind of came up? Is it partly how you came up with the Shades and that?
Yeah, so I mean, the Shades were. I wanted to have. I like monsters, you know. I've always kind of had monsters in my stories, and I've got a fondness for monsters and sort of strange beasties and things like that. So I wanted to have something physical. Something that's like a representation. I didn't want to go with ghosts. Not, you know, nothing against ghosts. Ghosts are great, but I wanted to do something a little bit sort of out there. So the Shades were kind of like. So this is a bit weird, but I actually have a genuine phobia of lampreys. I have a legitimate genuine phobia of lampreys. There's something about them that they're just wrong. They're just wrong. I don't know if you've ever seen one, but if I can't even Google one without like a full body shudder. They're the most awful creatures. So I already had in my head that this thing would resemble in some way a lamprey. So it was kind of like, I don't really know how it evolved from sort of like trauma turning into these monsters. It just kind of seemed like a good thing to put in there, because the other thing that sort of scares you when you're on the underground and things like that, particularly if you're late at night, is things like shadows and sounds and things like that. So it's, I thought that would be a good way to represent just fear, you know, personify the fear and personify it, but actually have something physical to be afraid of. Yeah. So it's one, sort of one step up from just trauma and fear. You're actually, there's something physical there to be scared of as well.
Coming after you.
Yeah, something coming after you. And the idea that these creatures are sort of not only coming after you, but are attracted to you and drawn to you, that you can't get rid of them. You know, for me anyway, that's the idea that you're being stalked by something or followed by something. That's a horrible, horrible feeling for me. So
it's very... Yeah, it's very, very atmospheric the way you wrote the novel. And I don't know if have you ever seen the film It Follows?
I have. Yeah. I saw it. I thought, oh god, it looks a little bit like I've copied this, but it's really good.
That's not what I'm meaning, because novel is definitely its own thing. And I very much came to it as its own thing, but there were certain elements, and that element of something stalking you and not being able to get rid of it, and also most people not being able to see it, but only a select few people being able to see it. There was that element that crossed over.
Yeah, I mean that's really interesting as well, is the idea of, you know, and that's something I really wanted to come to put across, the idea that so being able to see something that no one else can see, almost like sort of gaslighting yourself in a weird way. You know, is this really something that I'm seeing? Am I going mad? Is it manifestation of that, or is there something genuinely there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you play with that well, in terms of, at times it seems like it might be in the main character's, Alessa's, head, but at other times you're like, no, this is definitely a real manifestation of something.
Yeah, and that's kind of like so it's kind of like a soup of a story, really, because there's so many little ideas that I wanted to throw in there. Because when you sort of talk about the idea of trauma, and because obviously the central, you do have the bomb in the beginning, and that's kind of the backdrop to it. But I think what was interesting for me as a writer, but also I guess, you know, and somebody who has experience of things like anxiety and things like that, is how that can be horrific, and has sometimes, I think what I'm trying to get at is that sometimes the most horrific things are in your head, and no matter what is it going on outside your head, it can't, you know, often it can't compete with what's going on in there.
That's very, very true. There's I mean, the greatest fears are in your head. I mean, there's so many things that are amplified in your thoughts, especially if you are an anxious person or suffer in any way from anxiety or anything like that.
Oh god, definitely. And sometimes it's the most ridiculous things as well. Things that you're aware at the time are ridiculous, and you're no control whatsoever over the fact that you are afraid of this thing.
Yep. It's interesting how anxiety and trauma works like that, and I think you portray it very well in the novel, of the trauma that this woman is going through, and
really, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Obviously, you know, you always want it to be authentic, so you're not just using it as a plot device, you know. And for me, it was really important to have that, to put across that this is something, this isn't just for the story, this is something I really wanted to genuinely explore.
Yeah, I the characters are very well drawn, and I feel that the anxiety of Alessa is very well drawn, and also her relationship with Casey, who comes into the story and might know more than she's telling at the from when you first meet her. That's very well drawn as well, that relationship and how much information Casey is maybe not giving her. That's...
Yeah, Casey, so Casey's kind of like, even though she's in many ways a really awful character, she's also really a character that I really love. And I wanted somebody that, and you know, obviously I don't want to, you know, spoiler alert or anything like that, yeah, but yeah. Someone that was very, very flawed and did bad things, but ultimately wasn't a bad person, just somebody who acted in what they believed or what she believes is necessary. Because, you know, I've known people like that. I think everybody's known somebody like that or experienced someone like that who maybe is it probably in their heart is a good person or a decent person, but the fears or issues they're running away from. I think the problem with Casey is that her idea of confronting things wasn't actually confronting things at all. You know, I think that's there's the different ways of coping and different ways of healing. And I think what I wanted to show with Alessa was that the idea of healing does involve facing things head on, but it also involves sometimes introspection as well as sort of, you know, all guns blazing. I'm going to go tackle my problems. You know, you have to take time to sort of heal, properly heal, you know, as actually would for a physical injury.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, that's how you can overcome these things. It's the only way to let them be processed, like you say, exactly like a physical injury would be processed.
Yeah, I mean... Oh, sorry. Perfectly
fine. Go ahead.
No, I'll just say, I think, you know, obviously, I think a lot of people almost beat themselves up for feeling anxious or depressed or anything like that, you know, but it is, I really think it's conducive to good mental health to say this is comparable, treat it like a physical illness. If you broke your leg and you couldn't walk or run or, you know, or anything like that, you wouldn't berate yourself for not being able to do it. Because, well, you got a broken leg, of course you can't. But I think it would be it's healthy to think of it in the same way when you have a mental illness. Well, you know, okay, I can't deal with today. Well, that's because I'm ill. You know, it's a mental equivalent of a broken leg. You're not going to run a marathon, and sometimes you can't get through the day without needing to cry or without, you know, and that's okay. You know, I think we beat ourselves up for it, for these things, but it's not a failing.
No, absolutely not. And I think it is viewed very differently. You know, people view physical injury very differently to any sort of trauma or anxiety that people are experiencing. And people do beat themselves up more for not overcoming anxiety quickly rather than in the way they would not if, like you're saying, they had a broken leg or a broken arm or whatever it was.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think there's a societal issue there, and I think it's way, way bigger than to put to rights than either of us can here. But it's, you know, it's a really common theme that you see with people, and I think it's really important to encourage people that if you have a cold, you take time to heal. If you have a broken leg, you take time to heal. The same is true of this. You know, you have to encourage people to take time and to look after themselves. You know, the term self-care gets thrown around a lot, and that might mean different things to different people, but it's so important, and it's such an important thing to encourage.
Absolutely. And like you say, it's a massive societal thing. It's something, you know, that would have to be a complete overhaul of people's perceptions. And yeah, this fledgling horror podcast cannot does not have that sort of power. But maybe one day, but no.
You never know, you know.
No. To go back to the horror of the novel, I really think there's some very, very effective moments of horror that really got me, and particularly there's one moment where this is a mild spoiler alert, where Alessa has been bitten by one of the shades, and she starts hallucinating that Casey is turning into a shade, that the kind of black goo that they're made of is coming out their nose, and it's just a really creepy, chilling scene.
No, I'm glad that was effective, because it was quite gross writing it. I'm really glad that worked, because when I first wrote that, I wasn't sure that the whole kind of hallucination thing would it feel like a little bit of a weird detour, or like that bit in Dumbo where he hallucinates the pink elephants, you know, just what the hell is this doing here? But it was a sort of kind of a two things I wanted to achieve with that was obviously furthering the ambiguity, because you know, we're kind of spiraling down into this what the hell is actually happening here. Is Alessa going crazy, or you know, is Casey lying? What's the truth? But the fear of madness again, the fear of, you know, from Alessa's point of view, this kind of, she can't trust herself anymore, and can you, as the reader, your protagonist can't trust themselves, can you trust your protagonist? You know, is she, how reliable is she?
That was quite
disgusting, that scene.
it certainly reads that way. It's a very, very intense scene, and it's very it's pretty creepy, but like really good, just a really good bit of horror.
Thank you. It's always nice. Well, it's not nice to hear, but it is nice to hear.
That was another thing I was planning to ask you. Was it always horror you planned to write in? Or was that just something that you realized you wrote horror best? Or was that always your focus in terms of your writing when you first started to become a writer?
That's an interesting question, actually. And I don't know that I really know the answer to it. I've always written since I was... you know, when I say really small, I mean about 7 years old, and I wrote these poems, and I've always had an interest in writing. I've always wanted to write, but I didn't really start writing with a view to publish until I was about 24 or 25, which is about 2012 or thereabouts. And before then, I'd just, you know, I think I've written the sort of requisite fantasy epic that every kind of person who grew up with Final Fantasy and those kind of things is bound to write. And that didn't really fit. That didn't fit me. And then I kind of dabbled in cyberpunk, which didn't fit me either, because I don't know anything about technology. I am horrendous with technology and anything like that. And I think with horror, I've always liked dark stuff. I've always liked, you know, I remember... when I was young, about 8 or 9 years old or 10 years old, picking up James Herbert's The Rats and Stephen King's, I remember my nan bought me Cujo and Firestarter. And I think I was about 11 or 12 when I read those. And they're just, I've always been drawn to that kind of fiction, to dark and horrible and, or sometimes just downright creepy, spooky stuff, not necessarily horrific. So I think when I started to write, I didn't have anything in mind. It wasn't intentional. I didn't set out and say, I'm going to write horror stories. It just so happened that the things that I wrote were a bit weird. And weird in a kind of dark way. So it evolved from there. And then when I realised, hey, this is working and people seem to enjoy this, that, you know, okay, this is a niche that I'm quite happy to fit into. You know, I'm horror, dark fantasy, whatever you want to call it. I'm comfortable with this and I like writing this.
You mentioned the likes of James Herbert and Stephen King. Reading your novel, they don't seem like kind of direct influences. What direct influences would you say you have? Or do you have any? Or are you just trying to kind of build your own furrow within the genre?
Oh, I'd hope so. That'd be the ultimate goal, I think. But I mean, you think Stephen King and James Herbert sort of opened up a door for me when I was young, you know, because they were sort of readily available. They were yes. at that time. I mean, so I was growing up in the mid 80s, early 90s, and they were around, you know. But there was also, I mean, I'm probably aging myself a bit here, but there was point horror books when I was growing up, and they were in my school library, and they were kind of like horror, little short horror like novellas, I guess, but
yes.
teenagers. So slightly yeah. older than Goosebumps, but not quite adult yeah. level. And, you know, I'd sort of devoured those when I was young. I loved those.
I'm exactly the same. I'm 32, and I kind of got into horror the same way.
Oh, did you? Oh, brilliant! I'm so glad someone else remembers them.
the school library, the point horror series. Yeah. I remember reading a bunch of the point horrors, and that was kind of my introduction early. Horror novels.
Some of them were really good, and I'll probably go back to them now and read them and think, "Oh my god, what the hell is this nonsense?" But I remember reading. There was one in particular I remember about. Somebody who was on a skiing holiday and she broke her leg and she was laid up in bed and she was watching this murder play out in the cabin across the way from her. And it was very psychological. I remember, like 14, 13 years old. That was, oh, this is brilliant. This is great stuff. So I'm actually really glad that you remember them, because I say point horror and everyone kind of gives me this blank look like I've made it up or something. But
I have a similar thing, you know, like yeah. usually when I mention point horror to people, they're like, what? And then I usually just say, oh, it's like Goosebumps, but not.
Yeah, like Goosebumps, but slightly more grown up. Yeah, like Goosebumps for more sophisticated young adults. But yeah, they were really, I loved those books. They were great. So I was at secondary school A level when my teacher said to me, you should read Angela Carter. And at that time I was like, oh, you know, I'm a teenage goth rebel, I don't need to listen to your book recommendations, I read what I like. And it wasn't until I got to university that I picked up Angela Carter, and I thought, why did I not listen to my teacher sooner? This is amazing, this is the best thing I've ever read. So I would probably credit Angela Carter with being the first time that I read something and thought, this, if you know, I want to write like this, I want this is the sort of thing that I want to write, you know. I'd had sort of visions, like, you know, when I'd mimicked Watership Down and I tried to write a story about squirrels when I was about 11 or something like that. But Angela Carter was the first time that I read something, and it was just, I don't know what it is, and I still can't tell you what it is. It was The Bloody Chamber, and it's something about it just yeah. It sounds cheesy, but it just spoke to me, you know. I just thought, this is, I identify with this. I understand this. This is written for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, that's a great collection of stories, the Bloody Chamber and other stories. And Angela Carter is definitely an excellent writer to be influenced by.
Yeah, she's and obviously from Angela Carter, then you've got, she's like a gateway drug to other, you know, to like Margaret Atwood, for example, yeah. who, you know, some of her stuff is legitimately horrific as well. I mean, bits of Oryx and Crake, or the Mad Adam trilogy, and obviously The Handmaid's Tale, which is just, you know, particularly in the modern age, is unbelievably horrific with how believable it yeah. is. And then, you know, writers like Daphne du Maurier with Rebecca, again, which I think is a legitimate horror story couched in, you know, it's sort of a literary classic, but it is horror. It's undeniably a horror story when you read it. So I think probably gothic fiction and books like, I guess, dystopian, or what you probably, I don't know, it doesn't quite class as horror, but it's definitely on the darker,
got those spectrum, horrific elements within.
Definitely, yeah, yeah. And even people like Neil Gaiman and Chyna Mieville, who, again, probably more fantasy sci-fi than yeah. than horror, but have weird, uncomfortable, unsettling elements in their books, that those were the bits that I liked the best, the bits that you read and you were really discomforted by it. You know, that was, again, it was always, there was always a theme whenever I read anything, that the bits that I liked the best were the really horrible bits, or the really creepy bits, or the really weird bits. So, even though I read quite widely, you know, I wasn't exclusively a horror reader or a sci-fi reader or anything, but I loved books that made me feel uncomfortable in some way.
It's very interesting that you seem to be not really directly influenced by what would be classified as horror, but just the kind of general out there weird fiction, the dark gothic, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think since reading that, it's actually opened up horror fiction to me more now, because now I can say, you know, I've read, obviously I went through, every good goth goes through a Lovecraft phase, right? So, you know, I'd read Lovecraft as a teenager, bits and pieces of, but then, you know, I went back and read Macon, and I read M.R. James, and, you know, bits and pieces of those. But it's only since having that door open for me into horror fiction, it's not, I just jumped into it. I guess I didn't really know it was there, to be completely truthful. I wasn't, I was quite a broad reader, so seeking out horror writers, it sounds weird now, but it never occurred to me as a young adult, sort of in my early 20s, that people just wrote horror, which sounds weird, doesn't it? But because I think horror is so pervasive, and you find it in all other genres, horror crosses over into everything. So the idea that there was just a horror genre was kind of a bit of a revelation for me, which now feels horribly naive when I think back, and when I say that, you know, speak it out loud, it sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but it's true. I didn't sort of conceive of a horror genre. I just thought horror was something that you found in all books.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting take on it. And I agree. There's so many horror elements pervade so many different genres. I think as well, would you personally label yourself as a horror writer?
I quite happily wear that mantle. You know, I think some people could be a bit cagey about it. I don't know if there's an element of shame or whatnot. Now, whether other people would label me as a horror writer, I don't know, because I know that what I write has, you know, obviously horrific elements, but when you compare it to some of the other some of my peers, it's probably a bit on the periphery of horror, which is fine, you know, but I'm quite happy to call myself and to be called a horror writer. I think I'm quite proud of that, actually.
That's cool. I suppose some people might be worried of ghettoizing themselves. Maybe that's why they stay away from wanting to be labeled a particular genre writer.
Yeah, I get that. And it's especially, there's an ongoing sort of discussion in genre fiction circles about, like, if you go to Waterstones, for example, you know, Waterstones is a good example, I think, because apart from where I live, we don't have a Waterstones, which is disappointing, but you walk into Waterstones and you've got, in most Waterstones, you'll have a sci-fi fantasy and maybe a shelf of horror, or it's sci-fi fantasy and horror, and it's all just lumped into this corner of the shop.
Absolutely. And the horror doesn't tend to get treated that well in the shops. And generally, it's just Lovecraft, Poe, Stephen King, Dean Koontz, and maybe a couple other writers.
Yeah, and some paranormal romance, which, you know, nothing against that either. But even in Forbidden Planet, so, you know, I go to Forbidden Planet in London quite a lot, and they've got wonderful, wonderful selection of comics, wonderful selection of sci-fi fantasy, and even they have got a really, you know, stingy horror section. It's really the ugly sister of genre, I think, sometimes, horror.
I think so. I have a similar experience as a Forbidden Planet here in Edinburgh, and the horror is just, you just get like a very thin selection. You maybe get like a 30 Days of Night or something like that, and a few other things. But it's not,
I think also there's a flexibility with what gets labelled horror as well, and I think this is something else that's come up. I mean, okay, so you've got your classics like Dracula, which, you know, is horror but gets put as a classic. Yeah. For an example, so there's that. Then you get things like Mike Carey's Girl with All the Gifts, which was marketed as a thriller, which, again, clearly it's a horror novel. There's no two ways about it. It is horror. So you will go into general fiction, and you'll find an awful lot of stuff in general fiction that is flagrantly a horror novel or a horror novella or a horror collection. You know, as I was talking about Angela Carter earlier, and you won't find her in horror. you won't find the bloody chamber in horror, even though it is, to my mind, there's some truly horrific stories in that, or takes on stories. So, and again, if you go into the sci-fi fantasy section, there's such a crossover in there, and it depends, I think, what, and there's probably, again, a much bigger debate in here about how things get marketed and so forth. But I think horror is, we're kind of in a period of time where horror was really fashionable in probably in the 80s, and now it's not so much. I think horror is kind of, it's not a fashionable genre right now. So I think people tend to, if they can market it as a thriller and get a bigger audience and get a bit more, not the respect is the wrong word, but you know what I mean. Not have to be ghetto. Yeah, ghettoized is a really good word. I actually used that word earlier, and I think that's exactly right. You get sort of put into the ghetto of horror where, only weirdos and only goths and weirdos read horror books, you know.
Yeah. Well, you never know. It might be coming back around. I mean, cinematically, horror is currently flourishing as a genre. There's been big hits recently. Things like It Follows and Under the Shadow and Get Out was obviously the most talked about film of last year.
Although Get Out, I mean, one thing that really shocked me, I think I'm right in saying that it was passed over at the Golden Globes, wasn't it, Get Out, even though it was an absolute phenomenon of a film.
Very strange. It doesn't seem to be picking up any of the kind of...
And I think... The reason for that, I think you can make two reasons for that, but I think at least one of the reasons for that is because it's a horror film, and horror is, you know, when you look at the Oscars, you don't get genre films, you know, you won't see Blade Runner probably come up for an Oscar, even though I think the cinematography of that was one of the best films that I saw all last year. Popular, but it's almost like, you know, popular genre films is, oh no, that's dirty, we won't have that at the Oscars, that's too common, we can't, I don't know, it's... Funny how these things, you know, are so popular with the public, and people love them, and people talk about them. Because Get Out, when it first came out, was all I was reading about on Twitter, on social media, was people talking about this film and discussing it, and then, you know, I have to admit, I haven't actually seen it yet, which I really must do something about. But yeah, you couldn't get away from it. It was such a phenomenon. For it to be passed over, it just seemed obscene to me.
Yeah, I mean, the awards, the things like the Oscars and the Golden Globes are definitely, they're sniffy about a lot of genres, even comedy, sci-fi, particularly horror. I think the last horror picture, or what would probably be described as a horror picture, that won an Oscar was Silence of the Lambs. Back in like 91.
Yeah. And that was probably coming off at the tail end of when horror was fashionable, I think, and when horror wasn't a dirty word so much. But also Silence of the Lambs. See, it's funny, if someone published Silence of the Lambs now, it'd be marketed as a psychological thriller.
Absolutely.
It wouldn't be horror. You wouldn't think of it as horror. And yet, again, you read that book and it's a straight up horror novel. And the same with Hannibal. I don't know if you've seen the TV series Hannibal, which is probably one of my favourite TV series. It's just absolutely sublime. But it's a horror.
You talked about the cinematography of... That's one of the best filmed TV shows.
It's gorgeous. There's one shot I remember, I think in the last series, where it's in a butcher's in Italy, and it's just a rabbit hanging upside down and a drop of blood.
Yeah.
I think you must know what I'm talking about, because I think everybody was just, how can this shot of a drop of blood falling from a dead rabbit be so beautiful and compelling? And yet it was. It made murder beautiful. Hannibal, I think, is one of the best TV shows to come out of the last 10 years, easily.
Easily, yeah. I would totally agree with that. Mm. It was absolutely amazing show.
Yeah.
So you've had this novella, and you've appeared and done more short stories. I saw you recently appeared in a collection called Imposter Syndrome.
Yeah. It's I'm biased, of course, but it's a really cool collection. There's some great stories in that. it was really cool to be. It's again by Dark Mind, so you know it's yeah. They're great guys to work with, and they.
I must admit I've not read it yet, but I did read a very enthusiastic review on Ginger Nuts of Horror, and I'll definitely look into it.
It's yeah, I mean obviously completely discounting my story, but there are some. I was fortunate enough to read Tracy Faye and Georgina Bruce's stories beforehand. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, oh yeah, these are going to be when the book comes out, people are going to rave about them, and lo and behold, people have raved about them, and rightly so. And not just theirs, you know, Phil Sloman's story, Gary McMahon's story is really, really high quality all through. I think they picked a really, and I think it was such a fun brief to work to as well, because it was just imposters. So your take on imposters was down to you. You know, it was, you could go with chain things or doppelgangers or Capgras illusion and things like that. So there's such a wealth of things to work with, and everyone has worked the brief slightly differently. You know, you're not going to find the same theme repeated. It's yeah, I think it's really well put together. I mean, I say, of course I'm biased, but you know, even if I wasn't in it, I'd still say that.
What is your story? Give us a little taste of what your story is about, your contribution.
So I went with changelings, because so I've got family who live in the west of Ireland, and you know, obviously in the west of Ireland is very you know, it's still got quite a, there's talk of fairies and fairy forts and things like that. It's still a belief among people out there, which I've always found really fascinating. And changelings are particularly interesting, because there have been actual recorded cases, and not even, I mean, sort of mid-late 1800s of people, and I'd have to check my facts here, but a man who murdered his wife, burned her to death, because he sincerely believed that she was a changeling. So you're talking about a belief that's really, you know, yeah, strong in people. Yeah. So it's about twins. Again, I'm actually a twin myself, so
right.
You know, I was writing a little bit about twins in there. But twin girls who are just sort of going through puberty, and one of the twins becomes ill. She develops leukemia, and the other twin becomes convinced that her sister is a changeling. And yeah, the story goes from there. But changelings are just absolutely fascinating, just purely because of how real a belief they are, and how strongly people believe them, to the point where they would kill their own children, because the belief was that if a fairy had taken your child, the only way to get that child back was to burn, or to return the other child to the fairies, which could mean drowning them, it could mean burning them. There's all kinds of ways to do it, but it's terrifying, you know, that delusion.
Yeah. It's terrifying that people believe it so strongly.
Yeah, to the point where you'd actually murder your own wife. I mean, I don't know if there's some other pathology going on there. There probably is, but it's a real belief that people really had. And there's actually a really cool novel on that subject by Alison Littlewood, The Hidden People, which deals with changelings and that same belief, which I would highly recommend if you're interested in the subject. It's a really, really good book.
Absolutely. I'll definitely check that out. Mm. Absolutely. So what are you currently working on? Have you got more short stories lined up, or a novel, or another novella?
Right. I'm in quite a nice position at the minute, because I haven't got any commitments. I mean, apart from I'm actually at university at the moment, so I'm doing my master's degree. So apart from that, you know, an essay writing.
What's your master's in? I take it as
it's important. Sorry?
I was going to say, is it some sort of English lit or something?
Yeah, predictable, isn't it? Yeah, it's modern and contemporary literature, which is actually, turned out to be really interesting so far. At the moment, I'm my module is on the Victorian, and I'm going to say it's completely wrong, fin de siècle, which, I saw someone shouting at me for that. And it's a sort of turn of the century fiction, late 1800s, early
1900s,
and sort of that era of uncertainty. There's a lot of sort of fear about the turning of the century and where that's going to lead. And so you had Oscar Wilde was writing at that time, Robert Louis Stevenson, H.G. Wells. There's some really, really good, interesting fiction coming out at that time. So that's what I'm studying at the moment. As for writing, I'm doing a project at the moment which I've been thinking about doing for a long time, but it's quite intimidating subject matter. Not in the sense that it's scary or that it's, you know, horrible or anything like that, but it's something that I've wanted to write for a long time. But I think, I don't know, probably a lot of other writers would agree or understand this, I would hope anyway, that you build this idea up in your head of what you want the story to be, and then you kind of freak yourself out because you think, I can never achieve the story that's in my head. I'm never going to reach that. I can only ever
come out onto the page.
Yeah, it's not going to work. You know, I've got this, you know, beautiful, wonderful pearl of a story in my head, and it's going to come out and it's going to look like a squashed fly. You know, it's just not going to work. So for the last year or so, I've been flirting with this idea, and I finally decided I'm going to do it. So it's, I don't know if it's going to be a short story or a novella. We'll see where it goes. But I'm really excited about the idea. I think it's going to be, I hope, if I can do it justice, I think it'll be interesting anyway, at the very least.
Excellent. Can you give us a little hint of what it's about, or would you rather keep that under wraps?
I'll give a little hint. I'm really superstitious about this. I think because I have OCD, so I think it's related to that. So I've always had a weird superstition. Like, for example, I won't save the file as the title of the story, if that makes sense. Like, you know, when you save a document.
So you give it like a working title.
Yeah, I give it some random, or maybe I'll use a character's name or some completely random sentence that's not related to the story, because in my, you know, my little OCD brain is like, no, if you use the title, that story will never happen now. Right. So even though I know that's total nonsense, I just, you know, you kind of have to go with it. So I'm trying to break out of it. I'm trying to be good. So I will talk about it because, you know, I'm not going to let the story...
You don't have to give away too much.
No. So it's called... The story... The working title was The Pain Eater's Daughter. And I'm kind of working with the idea that... of an individual who travels the country, kind of like a word-of-mouth trade. And what he does is visits dying people or people who are terminally ill and... literally consumes the pain, so he it's not like euthanasia, but it's just so they can pass peacefully, and he consumes that pain, and it's told from the point of view of his 12-year-old daughter, who he's tried to keep his trade from. He doesn't want her to know what he does, and yeah, so the story kind of goes from there. But I just I'm not even sure where that idea came from. I think it was probably dreamed it or something, but yeah, I've wanted to work with this idea for a long time, but it's intimidating because it's quite a big idea, and it's quite a big subject, especially when you're talking about death and things like that. So yeah, it's absolutely. Yeah, I want to approach it with the appropriate.
You got to tread with care.
Yeah, I think so. I think you do. So I'm hoping. Yeah, I hope that it will be good and that it will be somewhat like the idea that I've got in my head.
Excellent, that sounds very interesting. I will look forward to reading it whenever it comes out, and yeah, I look forward to see how that story develops. It's a very interesting opening to the story, the very interesting setup.
Well, thank you. So you now have to write it now, so you give me motivation. So it's good. I've got expectations.
Absolutely, you absolutely have to now, and that seems like a good place to wrap it up. So it just leaves me to say thank you very much for being on this episode of New Horror Express, and best of luck with your story.
Thank you very much for having me, Scott. Appreciate it.
Hi, Chrissy. And welcome to the show. We've got you on today as we're going to talk about your first novel, Beneath, as well as a bunch of other stuff. But first of all, I was going to talk about the novel and just ask how the story developed, how you came up with the idea for the story.
Sure. Okay, first, thank you very much for having me. It's always exciting to be able to do a podcast or any kind of actually talking to people, because so much of writing, you don't talk to anyone. So it's always nice to be able to talk shop a little bit. But Beneath was actually it took a long time to get the entire story out, actually know where it was going. It had many, many different versions before it finally arrived at the version that it is now. Mm-hmm. But the idea really started, and this was back when I was in graduate school, part of our requirement for our final project was that we submit either a portion of a novel or an entire novel. And so I'd had this idea in the back of my mind for a really long time that I wanted to tap into, which was this idea of snake handling and faith, particularly this blind, unswerving faith that people have when it comes to religion. And I don't want to offend anyone. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. It's a wonderful thing to have faith, but that how often that faith is hiding a more insidious or a more wicked interior, where people will use that faith or will use that external part of themselves to, sorry, there go my dogs.
Sorry.
To mask those were my dogs barking.
Yeah.
But people will use that faith to mask these really, really terrible things internally. And that idea just wouldn't leave me. And so I started tinkering on it. It was originally my main character was not there. Of my protagonist, Cora was not there. Originally it was going to be only Ruth's story. So the story of her having a daughter in this Appalachian environment and how her faith was being tested. And then the further in that I got, the more I realized that I needed an external perspective who wasn't so embedded in that community. And once I did that, that's when the story really started to take off and I started to see its shape. But it took a long time to come to that realization of I left it alone for close to 2 years. I had about 100 pages of it and then took a very long break from it and then came back and said, okay, I really want to sit down and finish this. But I could not get the idea of those snakes out of my head. No matter what I did, I kept coming back to how terrifying that would be when that is the totem of your belief of something that scares so many people. And so I couldn't get that, shake that image.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of that, did you do much research in terms of the snake handling practices of the Appalachian churches, or was it just mainly based on what you already knew? Or
I did do a bit of research, and I've talked about this very frequently, of that my own background and my own childhood plays a big role in that book. I grew up in a very strict fundamentalist religion. I attended I was not a member of a snake handling church or of a holiness church, but I attended services at some of these snake handling churches. And it was funny for me, though, when I became an adult and realized that not everyone else had these experiences that I had when I was a kid. Well, what do you mean when you go to church on Sunday, they don't whip out rattlesnakes, and there aren't women, you know, passing out in the aisles and people talking in tongues and things like that. And so the research that I did, I wanted to make sure that I was faithful to the rules and the actual realities of that kind of a church, because I knew already that the horror of it was going to be so played up that I wanted to be fair to at least what that belief is in its most fundamental forms. I didn't want to glamorize it or over horrorize, if that's not a word, the reality of that religion. But I did some research, but a lot of it is based just on what I saw and what I experienced when I was a kid.
That's some experience. It's very far from my experience, I have to say. You know,
it is funny because it was so normal. It was so normal for me to go to that kind of a service and see those kinds of things. And so it's a rich background to pull from, but it is funny to think sometimes that when I start talking about some things and people's eyes just kind of go big and round and they go, wait, you did what when you were seven? And, it gave me the book, so I can't complain too much about it.
I have to say, reading the book as well, I would say that you're definitely fair in the book. It's not, you definitely don't glamorize anything, but you don't make any of the characters, even though some of the characters have a very blind belief, you don't kind of talk them down or caricature them in any way, or make them kind of, you know, big dumb caricatures of, you know, people who are very religious, in which, you know, some writers might have gone down that path of just being like having loads of religious nut jobs, but you make them quite rounded.
Well, thank you. That was something that I did want to be sure that I gave those characters the opportunity to not be just those very single-minded, you know, like you said, nut jobs living in the hills and totally isolated from the rest of humanity with zero awareness, because it is something where, regardless of belief and regardless of what that belief may be and whether or not people think that belief is too intense or too aggressive, there are still these very humanizing qualities about people who are even in these very intense religions and or very intense belief systems, whatever they may be. And there's good and bad in that, which is I really wanted to be certain that even, you know, with the pastor, with the preacher, that he's aware of what it is that he's doing, and he's aware of his own sin, and there's a struggle back and forth with him with that. So I wanted him to be human in that capacity. And even with Ruth, with the mom, with her unwavering belief. But even in that, she struggles. And so I very, very much wanted to show that, because I think that's everyone's struggle. We always struggle with what we believe in and what we don't believe in, regardless of what that is. So I didn't want them to be these kind of flat one note characters of just, you know, gap-toothed hillbillies.
You definitely did a good job there of making them believable, and even the characters who had some very extreme beliefs, and the character of Ruth is obviously a very dedicated to her belief, but even she had definitely some humane qualities that made you think like, oh, you know, it's not, she's not so single-minded that she can't see outside of it.
Right. And I really wanted to be sure, especially with her, because of all of the characters who either do believe or struggle with their belief, she was the one that stayed the most consistent in that. But that even though she stayed consistent, the way that she approached it changed. Of at first it was in the interest of saving her daughter, and then it was in the interest of, well, if I can't do that, then I need to do the next best thing, which is to rid the world of it. And then it's inevitably a shift in belief to something completely different, which I don't want to do spoilers just in the off chance that someone's like, oh, don't give away the end. So yeah. I won't do that, but that even though that belief stays the same throughout the entire thing, it shifts and changes as she shifts and changes.
Yeah. I was interested by the time period as well. Was there a particular reason why you set it in the 80s?
It is very interesting. Originally, it wasn't set in the 80s. It was originally modern, and this is unfortunately, I think, what's quickly becoming a crutch for a lot of writers who need to have a setting where there is no access to our modern technology, where if you truly need to isolate someone, or you truly need to make it to where a character isn't going to have awareness of what's going on around him or her, they can't have cell phones. They can't have smartphones. They can't have, you know, Wi-Fi and all of those other things that would be accessible in our modern day and age. And so, as I was writing it, there was the isolation of Hensley, of the community itself, and that those people would not have had access to those things. And it made plausible sense for those people not to have access to those things. But then as the story unraveled and Cora was introduced, and she, with her coming in from this outside perspective, she would have had access to those things. And so it really threw a wrench into where the plot was headed. And so as I was talking with the publisher, he mentioned, you know, well, what would you think about resetting this to an earlier time period, which ultimately, as I was doing edits, ended up being a much more enjoyable experience for me, because I was in that system. I was in that belief system in the late 80s. And right. So it felt natural then, as it was like falling back into a lot of the things that I remembered, a lot of my childhood, and that the feeling of it was easier as I was going back in and doing edits, because it was what I had lived. So unfortunately, the answer is a little bit of, you know, looking at how the sausage is made when you don't want to see how the sausage is made. But it was that I needed to have my protagonist not have access to the world, and that was it.
That makes a lot of sense, and I can imagine it's very difficult, because both in novels and in film, especially horrors and thrillers and things like that, when you do set things in the modern day, quite often there is a very clumsy scene that, you know, explains why nobody has any service. So it can be easier to set it in an earlier time period to avoid that kind of clunkiness.
Right, absolutely. Because I think at this point we've all seen that movie, yes, of that, where the character holds up a phone and they're staring at it and like, do you have any service? And no, I don't have any service. And there's only so frequently you can do that, in so many settings in which that can happen. And don't get me wrong, of taking the time period even back to purposefully avoid that issue is in itself becoming, I think, a little bit of a trope. But I'm hoping I squeaked under the bar just a little before people start going, I see what you're doing, you sneaky writer. So hopefully, but yeah, that's honestly the reason.
Yeah.
I wish there was a better one.
That makes a lot of sense. It does make a lot of sense. Talking about movies, actually, I felt that the novel was very cinematic. It seemed like a very visual novel. Like, I thought of a lot of different things while I was reading it. The Exorcist, The Evil Dead, The Children of the Corn, which I know is also a novel. Was that deliberate? Was it, were you influenced by cinema, or was that just maybe just a horror movie fan talking?
No, you're absolutely right. And I feel like I almost can't help writing that way. Mm-hmm. And even though I have been, and I think most writers would say this, that they've been lifelong readers, and I've loved fiction since I was a girl, and it wasn't horror fiction that brought me to the genre. And I think anyone who grew up in the period of the slasher flick, and going into the period of, you know, when Anne Rice dominated everyone's life, particularly if you were a very confused, angst-ridden 12-year-old girl, those films of that era were everything. Yeah. And so my love affair with horror in general actually started with film. Mm-hmm. And it was only later that I went, oh, there's books for this too. And because, you know, most of my salacious reading came from, and people may not know this, of like your Sweet Valley High books. And then slowly Goosebumps became a thing. The Goosebumps series. Yeah. I'm showing how young I am. And then the Fear Street novels and Christopher Pike. And so there were little hints and bits of it, but I was also not always allowed to have those books. But you could sneak around and watch those movies when somebody wasn't looking. And so all of my horror awareness was at the hands of my stepdad, who loved really bad horror movies and would let me watch them because he wanted me to like him because he was the stepdad. So it was a lot of, like you said, Children of the Corn, Pumpkinhead blew my mind. Chud. I remember letting me stay up and watch Chud with him, which is just a god awful movie, but I was fascinated.
Very funny movie, though.
It's very, very funny. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre and a lot of these just kind of pivotal movies of that era. And so I think that when I started developing the things that I wanted to write, I see them visually. Mm-hmm. Because that's how I approached the genre of I want to be able to physically see it. And so that just naturally started to translate into my own writing, where if, as I'm writing it, if I can feel like I can physically look up and look around, then I feel like it's working. And I think that film is what helps with that, as much as I should say that reading, you know, oh, you should go read. I think a good and a bad horror film can really teach you a lot when you're a writer.
Yeah. I did think part of what made me think that as well as it being a very visual book, there is a very funny scene when, not to give any spoilers again, when there is an attack where Cora makes a crack about the monsters being Children of the Corn wannabes.
Right. I was having a lot of fun in that moment because I wanted to poke fun at myself. Uh-huh. Because I could feel that scene tipping dangerously into Children of the Corn territory. And that was me actually talking to myself and going, okay, Denise, to rein it in, stop trying to be Stephen King, you're not Stephen King. Uh-huh. And just calm down. So having a little bit of fun with myself as the writer in that scene.
Yeah. Absolutely. I was also intrigued by the fact that the book is not, it doesn't go where you expect it to go. And it starts off very much as a kind of creepy, supernatural, Southern Gothic type novel. But by the end, it moves into almost Lovecraftian territory, which is not what I expected when I first opened the novel. But you seem to deal with that tonal shift really quite well. How did you do that?
Thank you for that. Because I think that there have been some readers who have not cared for that shift. I think particularly people who pick it up and maybe don't know my work or don't know the kind of writer that I am, and they go into it expecting it to be this very Southern Gothic, probably going to have something to do with possession.
Yeah.
And that expectation is embedded from the beginning, but I knew going in that I did want to go beyond that into a force that is truly inescapable, because I feel like in possession books, even though the threat is there and the devil is very scary, and I grew up thinking that the devil was the most terrifying thing of all, like there was nothing worse than the devil and what the devil could do to your everlasting soul. And so I went, okay, but in this world now, what scares me more than that? And that's this idea of that there's a force out there that's more ambivalent than that, because at least the devil cares about us, even if it's to claim who we are, at least he cares. Whereas if something that's more ancient than that has just been sleeping all this time and decides, okay, now's the time to come to life, like some terrible cicada, and is really doesn't care that much about human life, that's way more scary than the idea of damnation, at least for me. And so as I started to come up and develop the idea of the Great Worm as an entity or as a character in this book, I knew that I was going to have to very subtly take the reader with me, because it is hard when you've bought in as, okay, this is going to be a possession story, to now think, okay, well, we're going to go off the rails into a worm creature, really. And that, so I wanted the weirdness to start to seep in that first scene with Pastor Wayne and Leah, where she's been bitten by the snake and she doesn't feel quite right. And so I misspoke. It's the scene where Cora and Pastor Wayne meet for the first time, and they hear that the kids out in the, there we go, out there screaming. That, yes. I wanted that weirdness to go ahead and be there. There they go again. Good grief. I have three of them, so that's probably the issue. Good Lord. But that I wanted that weirdness to go ahead and start there. So yeah. That if I had the weirdness be slowly inserted and then slowly ramped up, that by the time things really got crazy, it had been preloaded.
It'd been embedded so in the story. Yeah.
Right. So that sense of strangeness of, okay, well, something's not quite right. It's obvious that there's something not quite right with this girl, but it doesn't feel like possession, not really. So taking everything that we normally would see in a possession story and turning it just a touch so that we know that there may be something else coming.
You definitely did that well. And I can see why people might rail against it and be like, whoa, this is not what I expected. But I very much went with it, and I think you dealt with that transition well. I was doing some research on you and looking at your website, you're often described as weird fiction, not necessarily horror fiction. Is horror a tag that you tend to stay away from, or is it just that's the tag you get?
It's so funny to me because that's the tag that I have gotten. I remember when I first started writing, I fully believed I was writing horror fiction. Yes. And that's what I was doing. And there was nothing else to it. And then all of a sudden I got an email that I had a story under consideration for the very, very, very first volume of Year's Best Weird Fiction, which was being edited by Laird Barron, who I had read and who I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And I went, huh, well, okay. And I didn't really think a whole lot of it other than like, this is exciting and it, you know, we'll see what happens. Well, then when I got the email that I had gotten into that anthology, mm-hmm. all of a sudden it was, oh, well, she's a weird fiction author, which I didn't ever, I will accept that tag because I read a lot of weird fiction and I enjoy a lot of weird fiction, but I just do think it's interesting because that's not anything I would have originally envisioned. And I certainly didn't truly know what it was until I started to be classified in that way. And then I went, okay, well, again, that's fine. I can kind of roll with this. I personally try to stay away from a lot of genre tagging, even though I know that that's the way of the publishing world. Everyone wants to know the genre.
Yeah.
In which you're writing. I love the term dark, of dark fiction.
Dark
fiction. Because I feel like that encompasses so much more. And that it can, because especially with stuff that I've done lately, some people would call it weird. Some people would call it dark fantasy. I'm starting to see the term fabulism thrown around quite a bit, which was, again, another surprising one where I went, really? But okay. So while my foundations will always be horror literature.
Yeah.
And certainly there are horror elements. There's these little bits of weird that start to sneak in and all these other things. So yeah, it wasn't something I gave myself, but mm-hmm. I'll take it. I will take it.
Fair enough. in terms of that, were you influenced a lot by horror literature, or were your influences more widespread?
In terms of your own writing? in terms of my own writing, it probably originally more widespread than anything else, just because my reading had been so focused in wide in the widespread of I was an English major, and so I spent all of my formative years buried in the classics and enjoying those very much, but then still gravitating toward horror fiction when I had time to read for myself. Mm-hmm. And or even reading things that weren't really classified as horror, but when I would put them down, it's like I couldn't get enough of it because there was something, mm-hmm. there was some weird thread in it that would so deeply unsettle me. I remember the first time I read Flannery O'Connor, and unfortunately I came to her late. I came to reading Flannery O'Connor when I was in my undergraduate degree, and remember reading A Good Man Is Hard to Find. And I was so terrified at how raw and how real that story was. And there was something about it that I went, that is what I want to do. That's the kind of fiction that I want to write. But then of course, also I grew up reading, devouring every Anne Rice book I could get my hands on. I mean, everything I could get my hands on, I would just ingest it. And so that was a lot of influence because granted, you know, people have their opinions about Anne Rice and about what's happened to her recently and her writing recently, which I understand, but there was something about how lush and how baroque and the characterizations that she could build that were so intoxicating that that was a huge influence.
I would definitely agree that, I mean, there's definitely a lot of great stuff in those Anne Rice books. Those early Vampire Chronicle books and stuff, they're great, you know, no matter what your opinion of her is now, like you say, and her writing now, you know, I mean, there's definitely a lot of great stuff there.
Oh, absolutely. And I think a lot of people who were around during that time or who were reading during that time, you can't deny the impact and the influence that she had on literature, on film, on writers of that time period. But in terms of influencing my own writing and people that I look to for inspiration to, of Poppy Z. Bright was a big one for me. Mm. Who is Billy Martin now? But additionally, right now, if I want inspiration, Helen Oyeyemi is. Helen Oyeyemi, White is for Witching. I read Mr. Fox. She has a new story collection called What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours. I think that's the title. She blows me away. It's singularly one of the greatest sources of inspiration currently. Joyce Carol Oates and the way that she writes, good grief, that woman can just. She can write. She'll die and still be writing circles around all of us. I don't know how she does it, but
she's certainly very productive.
She's very productive. I wish she would stay off Twitter, but she's very productive.
I think you could say that about a lot of folk. You know.
Oh yes, I think we'd all be much better if we stayed off social media, and I'm as guilty of it as the rest of us. But it's and childhood inspiration that I still think about. I loved the Narnia books. Oh my goodness. That was C.S. Lewis was a huge one for me. And even, I think Gemma Files, who's another wonderful writer, mentioned that The Magician's Nephew is probably one of the scariest books because there's that terrible world that those two children find themselves in with that dying red sun and everyone is sleeping and there's that terrible queen. And so a lot of the inspiration from my childhood reading, from the reading that I did, I always loved things that were just a little strange, just enough to make your skin crawl. I think Beneath takes it a little beyond that, but
I think definitely in terms of the gore and the sex and the violence, I think takes it a little bit ups the ante a little bit. I agree that there's a lot of stuff in those kind of what are essentially children's books that you look back on and you think, wow, that's quite heavy, quite hardcore for like what is for a children's audience or what's meant to be for a children's audience.
Right, absolutely. There's things that I loved when I was a kid that I look at now and I go, I would never hand that to my son at the age I was when I read that. But hey, I guess it's everybody has a road.
Absolutely, absolutely. Also, I noticed on your website that it says you've completed your second novel. Could you tell us a little bit about that or when it's likely to come out, be published?
I can tell you about it. And actually, that is very out of date. Not only have I finished my second novel, I have finished my third and have started my fourth. But currently, the second book is... There's no publishing date on the horizon, unfortunately. It is sitting with a handful of agents right now, hopefully knock on every piece of wood that I have, hoping that it will eventually get picked up by an agent and then get shopped around to some publishers. But the second book is called The Kingdom of Beasts, or at least it is right now. And that originated in that I had a friend who had, I think she emailed me a link to someone who was looking for a book about a theme park in New Orleans that is abandoned because after Hurricane Katrina, it's called Jazzland, they just never rebuilt it. And it actually, if you've seen Zombieland, it's the theme park in Zombieland. So it's that theme park. So it's completely abandoned and it's very creepy because you have all these children's rides just sitting and it's just, everything's overgrown. It's very eerie looking. And it got my wheels turning because I went, okay, well, everyone's done some, or, you know, there's been so many haunted theme park stories, or, you know, the kid goes into the haunted ride in the theme park and he doesn't come back out and all of that. Yeah. So I started to think about it. And then I had a dream, about a woman watching a child, and she believes that she completely believed that child was evil. And so they were in a theme park. And of course, because I had been thinking about it, this was in my dream. Makes sense. Yeah, yeah. And so they're in a theme park. And even though I wasn't the woman, I knew what she was thinking. And she was watching this little girl get abducted, but not doing anything about it because she felt like the little girl deserved it. And I woke up in just a panic. Because that's a huge fear of child abduction or child endangerment. Yeah. I hate child endangerment movies. It somehow always happens where I'm watching, I'm going, turn it off, kids in danger. And it was one of those, I couldn't shake that horrible, horrible feeling. And so that was the seed for The Kingdom of Beasts, is that this woman is a nanny. She's frustrated with her life. She feels like she can't get things off the ground. She can't find a real job. And she is going through some severe depression and she starts to have hallucinations and delusions that she believes that there are these creatures that are interacting with the girl that she nannies. And sure enough, she takes her to Jazzland one day and watches her be abducted and just lets it happen. And so the whole story then hinges around, flash forward 13 years later, she now has a daughter who's 13 and the daughter disappears. And she realizes that she has to go back and face whatever this thing was, or come to the final realization that it wasn't ever real. And so I really had a lot of fun with that book, but I will see if that one actually ever ends up out and about, but yeah. That was a fun one to write.
Excellent. Excellent. So you're now on your fourth novel. Unfortunately, outdated information.
I know. I'm so sorry. I do try to go in and update the story links frequently, but then the stuff that's on that main homepage, sometimes I go, oops, I need to make sure that I update that more frequently. So that's a good reminder. I'll do that today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time and being on the show today. Do you want to direct people to your website or Twitter, or where do you find you?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. I am online. You can find my website. It's just www.christydemeester.com. And as I say in everything, I have to always tell people how to pronounce my last name and spell my first. So it's K-R-I-S-T-I. D-E-M is in Mary, E-E-S-T-E-R.com. And my Twitter is the same. You can just find me at Christy Demeester. I'm usually pretty good about having people follow me on Twitter. Facebook, I'm less good about accepting people, but I usually just let those friend requests just sit there, unfortunately. But Twitter, I'm pretty open. And then I will, on my website, I do update the stories and the links and announcements and things like that. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for your time and talking to us. And if that second novel is published anytime soon, we can maybe have you back on.
I would love that. That would be great.
Okay. Catch you.
That was my guest, Christy Demeester there, who I would like to thank for being such an engaging interviewee. I'd also like to thank Laura Morrow, my other guest today, who is equally fascinating to chat to. If you agree with my assessment there, please do not forget to rate, review, share, and subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. Also, head on over to Facebook and give us a like, or follow us on Twitter. However, that is all for this month's episode. Please do tune in for next month's episode of New Horror Express.